TED Audio Collective.
Canva presents unexplained appearances. It was an ordinary workday until...
That presentation appeared out of thin air.
Also, it's eerily on brand.
Wait, did that agenda just write itself?
Words appear, making this unexplainable case...
Unexplainable? It's Canva's AI tools.
I can generate slides and words in seconds.
Really? The real mystery is why I'm only learning this now.
Canva.com. Designed for work.
You're growing a business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Hello, I'm Chris Anderson. Welcome to the TED Interview, the podcast series where I sit down with a TED speaker and we take a deep dive into their ideas. Today on the show, author Johan Hari and the massive but daunting topic of depression, a conversation which I actually found to be surprisingly uplifting. Pretty much all of us either have suffered depression or are close to people who have. Johan believes that the traditional story we've been told about depression is actually deeply misleading. It is not just about chemical imbalances in our brains. It's about real problems in our lives, problems we can actually address. Johan's TED Talk a couple years ago was about a related topic, drug addiction. He argued that the key question wasn't the habits people had formed, but why they had formed them.
The number of close friends the average American believes they can call on in a crisis, that number has been declining steadily since the 1950s. The amount of floor space an individual has in their home has been steadily increasing. And I think that's like a metaphor for the choice we've made as a culture, right? We've traded floor space for friends, we've traded stuff for connections, and the result is that we are one of the loneliest societies there has ever been.
So he built on that argument in his most recent book, Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and Unexpected Solutions. There, he identifies 9 specific causes that are rooted in how we've designed our modern lives. In our discussion, Johan shares his own personal history with depression and his numerous conversations with leading scientists and doctors in quest of a better understanding of it. Some of his conclusions have been controversial, and we discussed that too. I found the whole conversation absolutely compelling. If Johan's right, there are numerous things we can all do to improve our lives and our workplaces and our relationships and our communities. Johan Hari, welcome.
Oh, I'm so happy to be with you, Chris. Thank you.
So this is going to be such an interesting conversation. The TED Talk you gave a few years ago was about the war on drugs and how we were really not understanding addiction properly. And to understand addiction, you just really had to look, pay attention to the lost connection that a lot of addicts feel. You took that idea, that notion of lost connection, and started thinking about it much more broadly as a way of thinking about depression. This led to your more recent book, Lost Connections, which has become a big bestseller. And it's a very personal book, right? You yourself have suffered from depression. What you talked about in that book is incredibly moving. It's profound. It's in places controversial. We're gonna talk about all of this. I just want to say to people listening, this conversation isn't just relevant to you as someone who might have at some point been depressed or knowing someone or lived with someone who's been depressed. But really, I think for anyone who's just interested in personal happiness, and as you will hear, many of the ideas that Johan, I think, will speak about apply to all of us in different ways. In prospect, at least. Maybe we'll screw it up.
In prospect. You've oversold it now, Chris.
I'm interested in happiness. I want to be a happier person in a deeper way, and I want to make it possible for others to be so as well. Just even on that level, I'm super interested in this. So, Johan, I think what I'd love to do is just hear a bit of your story. Just tell us about your early life.
I guess
One of the reasons I wanted to think about this subject is because there were these two mysteries that were really hanging over me, kind of personal mysteries in some ways that, if I'm honest, I was really afraid to look into and I put off. I actually wanted to write this book before my book about addiction, Chasing the Scream, and I was too frightened to do it. The first mystery is I'm 40 years old, and every year that I've been alive, depression and anxiety have increased here in the United States and across the Western world. And I wanted to understand why. Right? Why are so many of us finding it so much harder to get through the day? And, you know, we're speaking just shortly after the Center for Disease Control here in the US announced that suicide is at its highest level they've ever recorded in this country. And that doesn't include the opioid deaths. So that's separate to them. So that was one mystery. And that was very connected, as you imply, to a much more personal mystery for me, which is, you know, I remember when I was a teenager going to my doctor and saying that I had this feeling like pain was leaking out of me. I couldn't control it. I didn't understand what was going on. I felt quite ashamed of it. And my doctor told me a story that a lot of people, this is the late 90s, loads of people listening to this were told this story, which I now realize was really oversimplified. It's not that it's got no truth in it, but it was really oversimplified. My doctor said, well, we know why people feel like this. Some people just naturally have something wrong with their brain. They have a chemical imbalance. Often they're lacking a chemical called serotonin, which makes people feel good. All you need to do is take these drugs and you're going to be fine. And I'm feeling a tremendous amount of relief at being told this. And I started taking a drug called Paxil or Suroxone in Britain. And I felt much better. I got a really significant boost. And then within a few months, this feeling of pain started to come back. So I went back to my doctor. I was told, you know, I didn't give you a high enough dose. Clearly, you need a higher dose. Again, I took more. Again, I felt a really significant boost. Then this feeling of pain came back again. So I was really in this cycle of taking higher and higher doses until for 13 years, I was taking the maximum possible dose, at the end of which I still felt awful. And I was asking myself, well, what's going on here? Because I'm doing everything I'm told to do by the story this culture is telling. It doesn't seem to be helping me. And I look around me, although it did give me some relief at first, it didn't ultimately solve my problem. And I could see that I was surrounded by many people in the same situation and many more who for whom the antidepressants were giving some relief, but were not ultimately solving the problem. So I wanted to use my training in the social sciences at Cambridge to really try to understand this. So I went on a big journey over 40,000 miles. I wanted to sit with the leading experts in the world about what causes depression and anxiety and crucially what solves them. And just people with really different perspectives, from an Amish village in Indiana, because the Amish have low levels of depression, to a city in Brazil that banned advertising to see if that would make people feel better, to a lab in Baltimore where they were giving people psychedelics to see if that would help. And I learned loads of things, but the heart of what I learned, and it's very related to what you said about happiness as well, the heart of what I learned is there's scientific evidence for 9 causes of depression and anxiety. 2 of them are indeed biological, and I hope we get a chance to talk about them. But most of the factors causing depression and anxiety are not in our biology. Most of them are factors in the way we live, some of which, not all, have been rising, which helps us to understand why there's been this big increase in despair in all its forms. And that was kind of shocking and revelatory to me. And then I learned that once you understand these causes, which is a much more complicated picture than what I was told, it opens up a whole different set of solutions that should be offered to people alongside the option of chemical antidepressants.
So before we get too deep into this, let's get a few definitions, I guess, on the table. I mean, depression, you know, the word is widely used. Some people just assume it just means someone feeling a bit down. How would you define depression?
The best definition I got was from Dr. Tyrrell Harris, a wonderful person who made a real breakthrough about depression in the 70s. She said, everyone has feelings of hopelessness sometimes. Depression is when that feeling of hopelessness spreads like an oil slick over most of your mind or most of your life. I thought that was a pretty good definition.
I mean, it becomes, for many people, completely debilitating. You literally can't get out of bed. I mean, I've lived with people who are depressed, and it's more awful to experience than pretty much any other sort of disease that we're familiar with. It's because it stops you having any pleasure in anything. Depression at that level, I mean, I wonder whether that story that you're told, we'll come into this in a bit more detail, but one of the people I was living with who suffered so badly from depression, a doctor told her a similar story. And part of the motivation it felt for that was to say to her, you know, stop blaming yourself. This is not your fault. By taking away the blame, it took away, for her, at least for a while, part of the sort of self-fueling cycle of, oh, this isn't about the awful things I've done to myself. I'm just unlucky.
Yeah, what you're saying is really important. And I think the word unlucky you used is really important as well. So I used to say and believed exactly that argument, that there was two choices. There's either the kind of false argument that if you're depressed, you're just weak, you need to pull yourself together, or there's the biological, the overwhelmingly biological argument, it's just a problem in your brain. And of course, if those are the two choices, we would all choose the biological story to tell to a depressed person. The truth is a bit more complex, and actually there's interesting evidence that telling this heavily biological story, while totally well-intentioned, as you say, is not actually the best path out of stigma. So there's a very broad agreement. Many of the things we'll talk about, there's arguments about, there's a very broad agreement among scientists who've looked at this, that there are three kinds of cause of depression and anxiety. There are biological causes, which are very real. There's things like your genes. Your genes can make you more sensitive to these problems. In the same way, everyone knows some people find it easier to put on weight than other people. I am one of those people who finds it incredibly easy to put on weight. I hate those people who find it really hard to put on weight. But equally, that doesn't write your destiny, right? If you're someone who finds it easier to put on weight, that doesn't mean you're preordained to put on weight. Similarly, there are also real changes in your brain that happen when you become depressed that can make it harder to get out. But alongside those biological causes, there are psychological causes.
So just explain the psychological causes a bit. It's literally the beliefs you have can make a difference as to how you feel about yourself.
Yeah, so relation to your psyche. So, for example, if you were abused as a child and you internalized the voice of the abuser, to give an extreme example, that's a psychological cause of depression.
And that's where cognitive behavioral therapy can make a difference, whereby changing what you believe, you can shift some of that feeling.
Exactly. That's a good way of putting it. And then there, alongside those two sets of causes, biological, psychological, there are also social causes. There are factors in the way we live together for which there's very strong evidence can increase depression and anxiety. So the truth is are complicated, but not so complicated that the ordinary person can't understand it by any means. This is called the biopsychosocial model. Hmm. In theory, this is what everyone believes. Just to go to a really important thing you said about your friend. So like I say, for a long time, I thought, okay, there's this choice. There's either the condemnation of personal weakness, which is obviously gross, or there's telling people, don't worry, what I was told, and did find, like your friend found initial relief in, oh, it's just a biological problem. But I think there's several problems with that. Firstly, if you don't understand the broad range of complex causes that are making you depressed, you can't find a meaningful solution. So let me give you a concrete example, because that can sound a bit fancy and abstract. This here in the United States, we are in the loneliest society there has ever been. There's a study that asks Americans, how many close friends do you have you could turn to in a crisis? And when they started doing it years ago, the most common answer was 5. Today, the most common answer is none. It's not the average, but it's the most common answer. There's a study, more recent study, that asked Americans, how many people know you well? And 50% of Americans said nobody. And I spent a lot of time interviewing an incredible man called Professor John Cacioppo, who is in Chicago. He sadly just died. He was the leading expert in the world on loneliness. I remember him saying to me, why are we alive? Right? Why is everyone listening to this show alive? One key reason is that our ancestors in the savannas of Africa were really good at one thing. They often weren't bigger than the animals they took down. They often weren't faster than the animals they took down, but they were much better at banding together into tribes and cooperating. This was our superpower as a species. Just like bees evolved to live in a hive, humans evolved to live in a tribe. We are literally the first humans ever to try to disband our tribes, and it's making us feel terrible. If you separate a bee from its hive, it'll go crazy, right? If you think about the circumstances where we evolved, if you were cut off from the tribe, you were depressed and anxious for a really good reason. You were in terrible danger, right? Mm. Now, that can seem like a very big thing. There's overwhelming evidence that loneliness has gone up, and there's overwhelming evidence that loneliness causes depression and anxiety. It's one of the factors that helps us to understand why this crisis is growing.
You know, we'll dig into some of the causes, because you've got lots of them, and I think they're all really interesting and worth exploring. But the broader point it seems like you're making here is that, look, if depression is supposed to be signaling something real about the environment, to just take a biological response to it is as foolish as to say to someone who's got their finger in a candle flame, don't worry, we've got pain reliever medicine, take it, and you know, the pain will go away. and it will, but your finger slowly goes up in smoke.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful way of putting it. And crucially, if you think about that analogy, what it stops you from doing is finding the solution, which is, let's take your finger out of the candle. But let's think about loneliness. One of the heroes of my book, Lost Connections, is an amazing doctor in East London, a poor part of East London where I lived for a long time, called Sam Everington. And Sam, he's a general practitioner, and he was really uncomfortable because he had loads of patients coming to him with terrible depression and anxiety. And like me, he's not opposed to chemical antidepressants. He thinks they have some role to play, but he could see two things. Firstly, his patients were depressed and anxious for perfectly understandable and actually quite obvious reasons, like loneliness in most cases. And secondly, most of the people he gave chemical antidepressants to got some relief, but it didn't solve the problem. One day, a patient came to see Sam called Lisa Cunningham, and I got to know her pretty well later. But Lisa had been a nurse, and she'd actually been shut away in our home with just the most terrible depression and anxiety for 7 years. And Sam said to Lisa, "Don't worry, I'm going to carry on giving you these drugs, but I want to try something else." There was an area behind the doctor's surgery that was just like scrubland. The suite of doctor's offices had behind it like this kind of green scrubland area. And Sam said to Lisa, "What I'd like you to do is come and turn out a couple of times a week. I'm going to come too because I've been feeling really anxious. We're going to meet with a group of other depressed and anxious people, and together we'll find something to do so we're not lonely." The first time the group met, Lisa was literally physically sick with anxiety. She vomited. But the group starts talking. Lisa comes back. They're trying to figure out what they can do together. These are inner city East London people like me. They don't know anything about gardening. They decided they were going to learn gardening. They start watching YouTube clips. They start reading gardening books they get from the library. And they start to get their fingers in the soil. They start to learn the rhythms of the seasons. There's a lot of evidence that exposure to the natural world is a really powerful antidepressant. But something even more important starts to happen. They start to form a tribe. They start to form a group. They start to care about each other. And they did what we do when we form tribes. They started to solve each other's problems. So to give you an extreme example, and this is the most extreme example in the group, but one of the people there had been thrown out by his wife. He was sleeping on the local bus at night because the drivers would let me, had nowhere to go. Everyone else in the group was like, "Well, of course you're depressed if you're sleeping on a bus, right?" They got together, they started pressuring the local authority and helped this guy get a home. It was the first time they'd done something for someone else in years, and it made them feel great. Hmm. The way Lisa put it to me, as the garden began to bloom, we began to bloom.
And you can certainly imagine that it's hard for some doctors to, like, people may feel that they're being sort of paternalistic or whatever, to sort of probe into some of those details. And it's simpler to give a drug-based treatment in some ways. And perhaps people feel that there's a sort of judgment involved in, you know, who am I to judge someone else's lifestyle? Before we go on to some of those more sort of social causes of depression, one thing that I found really interesting was your discussion about looking into some of the evidence for the effectiveness of drugs. I mean, there is evidence that drugs are beneficial in certain circumstances, at least for a while.
Yeah.
But you talk a lot about how it's really confused by the fact that placebos are also remarkably effective for a bit. And the difference between a drug and a placebo may not be that great, and that is weird.
But there is a broad scientific agreement. Chemical antidepressants in the first 2 months have a significantly higher effect than placebo. It's not a huge gap, but it's significantly higher. So we want to stress that.
Talk about your biggest sort of aha moment as you look back to the research that's been going on.
Chemical antidepressants are only a small part of the book, but to be honest, I found that really painful to learn about, because the one thing I had been offered as the solution was chemical antidepressants. And I think when you have a story about your pain, even when that story isn't working well, and clearly that story wasn't working well for me, I was still depressed, at least you feel like you know where you are. And there was this moment when I was learning the truth about chemical antidepressants, which is complex and is not that they have no effect and don't work at all, that felt quite destabilizing. So I just want to say to any listener who feels that way, I empathize with you, and I felt similarly. So there were a few things about chemical antidepressants that were quite striking to me. Depression is generally measured by something called the Hamilton scale, and it goes from 1, where you would be dancing around in joy, to 51, where you would be acutely suicidal. And to give you a sense of movement on the Hamilton scale, If you improve your sleep patterns, you'll generally gain about 6 points on the Hamilton scale. And if your sleep patterns deteriorate, you'll lose 6 points on average. So the leading expert at Harvard Medical School, Professor Irvin Kirsch, when he got hold of all the data, including the stuff the drug companies didn't publish, found that on average, chemical antidepressants move people 1.8 points on the Hamilton scale. So that's about a third of improving your sleep patterns. It's important to say a few things. Firstly, that's an average. Some people will get consistently more. I got more initially and got less over time. Also important to say 1.8 points is not nothing. If you're acutely suicidal, that could be the thing that gets you off the bridge, right? Also important to say, some people think Professor Kirsch's statistical analysis underestimated and it's more like 3 points. But hardly anyone thinks it's more than three, which is quite striking to me. What I found most shocking, I thought there was something wrong with me in that it had initially given me some help, but over time, I'd gotten depressed again. Actually, the best long-term research into chemical antidepressants is something called the STAR-D trial. There's actually shockingly little research into long-term effects, but the best long-term research we have is the STAR-D trial. It's really simple. They just follow people who went to their doctor saying they're depressed, who are given drugs, to just see what happens. And what it found is, and there's a big debate because it depends how you put the threshold for depression, but what they found on most interpretations is most people did become depressed again. Again, doesn't mean there was no help to people, there was some, but that was quite difficult for me to learn, even though it actually confirmed my own experience. And this culture we built is good at lots of things. I had to go to the dentist last week. I'm glad to be alive in 2019. But we've been getting less and less good at meeting these deep, underlying psychological needs. And it's not the only thing that's going on, to be sure, but I think it's the biggest reason why this crisis is going up year after year.
So let's dig into some of these other causes that may be underreported reasons why many people are feeling depressed, miserable. You've already spoken a bit about loneliness. In the book, you talk a lot about another huge cause, which is like meaningful work. So many people do not have that. Talk a bit about that.
This was really shocking to me. I actually think it's probably the single biggest cause that if we fixed it would most significantly reduce depression, although that's going a little bit beyond the evidence. It's my hunch. So I noticed that loads of the people I know who are depressed and anxious, their depression and anxiety focuses around their work. Everyone listening will know someone like that. So I started to look at what's the evidence about how we feel about our work. Gallup, the opinion poll company, did a huge study. And what they found was 13% of us, 13%, like our jobs most of the time. 63% are what they called sleepworking. You don't like it, you don't hate it, you just kind of get on with it. And 24% of people hate and fear their jobs. I was quite struck by that. That means 87% of people don't like the thing they're doing most of their waking life. And this thing that we don't like is spreading over more and more of our day. The average person now answers their first work email at 7:43 a.m. and clocks out at 7:15 p.m. I started to think, could this be having some effect on our mental health? So I learned that there was an incredible Australian social scientist, a really remarkable man called Professor Michael Marmot, who'd made a breakthrough about this in the 1970s. So I went to go and see him. Professor Marmot explained to me the key factor, it's not the only factor, but the biggest factor that causes depression and anxiety at work. If you go to work tomorrow and you have low or no control over your work, you're significantly more likely to become depressed and anxious. Now, I'm going beyond Professor Marmot here, but I think that's because it relates to what we say about needs. You need to feel your life is meaningful, right? You need to feel that you have purpose. And if you're just like a robot on a line, then it's very hard to construct meaning out of your work. But I actually, when I was learning all this, I actually misunderstood what it was telling me. So I thought at first it was saying, okay, you've got this elite 13% of people at the top, like you and me, get to have nice lives where we do things we enjoy. And then you've got this everyone else who's condemned to this kind of controlled misery. And I thought about, you know, my grandmother's job was to clean toilets. My dad was a bus driver. My brother is an Uber driver. I thought, wait a minute, are we saying they're condemned? But Professor Marmot kept saying to me, it's not the work that makes you depressed. It's being controlled at work.
Nonetheless, I mean, some people listening to this will feel, I mean, I wish I could be an entrepreneur. I wish I could, you know, quit and start my own business. That might be a step too far for me. There are other ways.
That's definitely not what I'm... Yeah, it's important to say, I'm not saying people... This is an argument for a big structural change in our society. If you argue for a big social change, like let's democratize our workplaces, what a lot of people hear is you're saying, I, as an isolated individual, need to go and set up my own democratic business, which is... Do you see what I mean? It's a...
So let's agree that there's lots that society could do to restructure work. And I think come what may, we're probably entering an era where there will be many more people basically working entrepreneurially just because they have to. The gig economy is nothing if not basically fundamentally, you know, like the jobs aren't there. So what else is there other than to take some form of control? But while that happens, aren't there also stories of people who are in jobs that you or I might see as mundane, but who nonetheless find a way of giving them meaning? I mean, you read, maybe it's over-romanticized, but I mean, you read about, I think Barry Schwartz in one of his TED Talks spoke of a hospital porter who just took huge pride
This is a great example.
In not working just according to a set of rules, but in imbuing meaning into the relationships he had with the patients and so forth.
Absolutely. It's a great example. My grandmother cleaned toilets in a hospital. She was very similar to that. My grandmother's one of the best people I've ever known. Actually, hospitals are a really good example. So Britain, in the 1990s, hospital cleaning was privatized. So it used to be controlled by the hospital, and then it was given to private companies. And there was this interesting shift that's been studied. Daniel Pink has talked about this amongst others. So previously, hospital cleaners saw a big part of their job, exactly what you say, in part, obviously their job is to clean the hospital, but a big part of their job as well, as my grandmother would have told you, was to josh and, you know, talk to the patients, to distract them, to, you know, put their arm around one of the crying relatives, whatever it would be. So they entirely rightly, because they had some control over their work, identified the most useful thing for them to do, which was primarily clean the hospital, but lots of other things that gave their life meaning and enhanced the meaning of the people in front of them. Then when privatization happened, there was an enormous diminishment in the amount of control that workers could exert in that situation, right? They were told, that's not your job, shut up and clean. And what we know is there was a huge decrease in job satisfaction among hospital cleaners. There was a huge decrease in satisfaction among the patients in the hospitals who wanted this person they could see in front of them to be able to help them. So that's a great example of how exactly the principle that I'm articulating. Most people want their work to be meaningful and want to do work. When you give them control, they will respond to the need in front of them. They will find ways to make that work meaningful.
And certainly if you're running an organization, just figuring out, like answering the question why seems to me like a really fundamental one for people. It's like, it's not just do this. It's here's why we're doing this. And by the way, if you can think of a better way of doing it, I would love to know. That sort of culture of we're in this together, there's lots of sort of small ways that people can try to address that meaning thing. But I agree with you. It's shocking to me how many people view work purely as the necessary evil to earn the money to survive and so forth. That feels like an absolute crying shame.
I didn't want to be romantic about the past. There were lots of things. There were people who worked in mining in my family, and believe me, they were not having a great time of it. So not being romantic about the past, but we have moved towards greater control for a lot of people, greater monitoring and so on, and therefore less meaning in their work.
Moving on from that to a second cause, I mean, you talked about loneliness, and I think you also framed that as just the general loss of community that's happened in so many parts of the West. Talk a bit about that. You know, the story of the West, lots of parts of Middle America, the story, I dare say, horribly oversimplified, it is often told as community after community where traditional jobs have gone. You know, there's huge levels of disability, addiction, alcoholism, you know, and the real just sort of fraying of community. Religion plays a less big role than it used to. Can you imagine similar kinds of community rediscovering itself? What would be the catalyst for that? How could anyone who's interested in policy do something that would encourage that? Or is it just down to local individuals saying enough and someone taking the risk and starting to knock on doors and saying, let's take on some project? I mean, is part of the key to do something together, not turned inward, but kind of turned outward to take on something, whatever that something is?
Yeah, I think you're asking the really profound and important question. And I don't want to act like there's a kind of standard answer. There are things we can do at a policy level. So for example, that approach, the gardening program in East London, is part of a wider approach that's called social prescribing, where you prescribe for depressed and anxious people to take part in groups. The British government has now announced a huge rollout of social prescribing. So there are lots of policy things that can activate this reconnection. But I think you're right that a lot of it has to be, we have to change our perspective on it. And part of that is we have to change our story about what depression is. Because one of the, while there are real biological aspects, and it's important to stress that, clearly our biology has not changed in the last 40 years, or not significantly. So there's something deeper going on here, or something parallel going on here. One of the key reorientations I went through when I was writing Lost Connections and interviewing all these people was to realize for the longest time, I thought my depression was a pathology. It was a malfunction. It was something wrong in the coding of my brain. And what I learned from a lot of these people is a huge amount of the depression and anxiety that we're seeing is in fact a signal. Think about that really good metaphor you had. You evolved to feel terrible pain when you put your finger in the flame of a candle because you are in fact being horribly injured. You're in danger. And if you keep it there, you're going to be really badly injured. And in fact, in the circumstances where we evolved, it might well have killed you, the infection. In a similar way, I've come to think, agonizing though they are, and depression is the worst thing I've ever been through, these are signals. They're telling us something. The fact that more Americans are committing suicide, the fact that more people have now died in the opioid crisis than have died in, than American soldiers died in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq combined, those are signals that are telling us something has gone terribly wrong. And what we've been doing up to now, often with good intentions, as you said before, is I think unwittingly insulting those signals. We've either been saying that they're a sign of personal weakness or personal flaws or just a biological problem in the brain, when in fact, while there, of course, some depressed people have personal flaws and there are real things going on in the brain, we need to hear the signal of why it's rising, because that signal is telling us something, right? It's telling us what we're doing wrong, and it can help us figure out how to get it right. And this is partly what the best social science is, reading those signals. One of the things I think about a lot of the progress that everyone listening to this has lived through, and I think particularly about a friend of mine, Andrew Sullivan. Andrew was diagnosed as HIV positive at the height of the AIDS crisis when there was no hope in sight. His best friend Patrick had just died. And Andrew quit his job. He was the editor of the New Republic at the time. And he went to Provincetown, a little town in Cape Cod, to die. And Andrew decided he was going to do one last thing before he died. He was going to write a book. He was going to write the first book about a crazy utopian idea. He's like, I'm never going to live to see this happen. No one alive now is going to live to see it happen. But maybe someone somewhere down the line is going to pick up this book and this idea. The idea he was the first person to ever advocate at book length was gay marriage. And when I get discouraged, I try to imagine going back in time and saying to Andrew, I'm going to go back to 1994 when he's sitting there in his little cottage in Provincetown, and saying to him, okay, you're not going to believe me, but 24 years from now, A, you're going to be alive. That would have seemed impossible. B, you're going to be married to a man. That's going to be legal. C, I'm going to be with you when the Supreme Court of the United States makes it mandatory for every state in the union to introduce gay marriage. And they're going to quote this book you're writing now. And the next day, you're going to be invited to have dinner with the president in a White House lit up in the colors of the rainbow flag to celebrate what you and millions of other people have achieved. And by the way, that president who's going to invite you, he's going to be black. Every aspect of that would have sounded like the most absurd science fiction. And yet all of us live with progress that seemed like science fiction. The women listening don't need me to mansplain it to them. But, you know, when my grandmothers got married, they weren't allowed to have bank accounts in their own names. In human history, that's 5 minutes ago, right? So all sorts of positive changes that are required in order to reduce our depression and anxiety crisis and addiction crisis are possible and can be achieved. We need to give people back this sense of collective agency of what we can achieve together.
And I guess to the extent that we can solve issues around community and bring back a greater sense of community out there, it actually solves a lot more than depression. I mean,
absolutely.
Like so many problems in the country to do with, I don't know, like every measure you can look at, from lifespan to how our kids do. You know, so many of these things are basically connected to community. So it's definitely a goal worth aspiring to.
And there's a great example, and you mentioned, you're totally right. If you think even about physical health, it's really interesting studies that take people and expose them with their consent to the common cold. Lonely people are more likely to catch the cold than people who are not lonely. I mean, there's evidence that loneliness is as bad for your physical health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So you're absolutely right. Loneliness is a catastrophe across the board, and all sorts of problems flow from a deeply lonely society. And if you, I know that's, I want to stress, it's only one of the nine causes that I write about in Lost Connections, but I think you're right that it's an absolutely crucial one.
So I want to look at two more of the causes. I mean, it's all so interesting. And you've got a whole chapter devoted to the natural world and how, you know, are spending less time, especially city dwellers, spending a lot less time in nature, may be part of the story. What's the evidence for that?
I found this quite challenging because I'm a real city boy. There's loads of evidence of this, but our mutual friend Isabel Benke, one of the, I really urge everyone to watch her incredible TED talk about play. And Isabel, like we were saying, is one of the most glamorous, clever and amazing human beings in the world. Isabel really helped me to understand a lot of this. She said she would only explain it to me if I agreed to walk up a mountain with her, which is very contrary to my natural disposition, which is to sit at the bottom of a mountain and read a book. But she did. So there's many ways to think about this. But one is the state prison in Michigan. It wasn't designed this way, it's just by chance, has one part that looks out over beautiful greenery, the natural world, and one part that looks out over a parking lot, just a concrete parking lot. And it was random where you ended up in the prison. People who looked out over the lush greenery were 20% less likely to develop illnesses of all kinds, which is quite striking. And there's a debate about why this is, which is not settled, and I want to stress that. But I think there's a few factors for which there's pretty good evidence. So one is we know that animals in zoos, deprived of their habitats, go crazy, right? It's called zookosis. Hmm. So horses will start obsessively swaying. Elephants will grind their tusks, which are a great source of pride in the wild, down to bloody stumps. Parrots will start ripping out their feathers. And there's an argument that partly what's happening is we're having a kind of zookosis, right? We've been deprived of the natural environment that we evolved to live in, and it's making us feel awful. That is one thing that's going on. Another thing that's going on, and I think this is one of the reasons why I found it quite challenging. So we know that in the natural world, in beautiful scenes of nature, most people will have a sense of awe. And one of the things depression is feeling trapped in your own ego. It's like your thoughts are rattling around, you can't get any relief from them. And moments of awe give people a relief from ego. In a feeling of a state of awe, you feel like the world is big, you are small, and you're part of this great tapestry of life, as I remember Isabel putting it to me. And for a lot of people, that gives a sense of relief. It's also why meditation gives people some help. It's also why psychedelics, one of the reasons, not the only one. Also psychedelics. The psychedelic experience can give people a lot of relief. And I interviewed a lot of scientists about that. But I actually didn't get that relief for a long time. And I didn't understand why. I actually, in moments of feeling I was small, felt really endangered. And I think it may be related to the other course that you wanted to talk about. But I had experienced some very extreme stuff when I was a child. I'd gone through a lot of childhood trauma. And actually, one of the ways that some people survive childhood trauma is actually by building up a very strong sense of ego walls, by actually guarding yourself. So I would do it partly by constantly working, reading and writing, even from a very young age, and partly by building up these walls of defense. And if that's been your way of defending yourself and your way of surviving, actually a moment of feeling you're very small and your ego's been shrunk won't feel liberating. It will actually feel frightening. And that's partly why you need to deal with those underlying issues. We can talk about how, if you want, to get to that feeling of awe and that feeling of liberation.
I mean, I certainly know for myself, walking in nature is just like, it's just a basic boost to well-being. When I came to New York, 2004, I love the city, but I found it deeply stressful, just the intensity of it. And the remedy was go and walk by the river every morning and right. Or run or whatever. And that made all the difference. What is the wise advice to someone? Like what is enough nature dosage and what counts? Like, can you sit at home and watch a David Attenborough documentary, or do you actually have to get out and do something physical in nature?
So I asked a lot of the experts this, and one of the things that was surprising is relatively small doses. I don't think screens count, but relatively low doses. So for example, gardening in the middle of a city doesn't have the same effect as going out into a beautiful natural landscape, but has a significant antidepressant effect. Again, Isabel Benke, wonderful Chilean primatologist, is a great exponent of, she thinks part of it is just actually about physical embodiment and movement. We were creatures who moved long before we were creatures who thought and spoke. And she argues, and there's good evidence for this, that part of it is actually about physical movement. She says no human that walks less than 8 hours a day should be regarded as healthy, which is, you know, got a bit too far for me. But it's partly that there's a lot of things going on. But even relatively small doses give some help and relief.
So you mentioned childhood trauma. I mean, tell me, if there's someone out there who has suffered trauma, what would be the one piece of advice to start to escape from that?
I would tell them a story, if it's okay. So in the mid-1980s, a doctor called Vincent Felitti, who I got to know later, was approached by Kaiser Permanente, a big not-for-profit medical provider. And they said, look, we don't know what to do and we need your help. Obesity was going up and up and nothing they were trying was reducing it. And so it was really eating up their medical costs and was obviously a disaster for the people who were becoming obese. So they gave him quite a big budget and they said, look, go away and just do blue skies research, figure out what the hell we can do. So Dr. Felitti started to work with severely obese people, people who weighed more than 400 pounds. And one day he had an idea that seems, and in some ways is, quite dumb. He asked himself, what would happen if really obese people literally stopped eating? Would they just burn through the fat supplies in their body? So obviously they would give them like vitamin C shots so they didn't get scurvy, things like that. So they started to do it with tons of medical supervision. And incredibly, at first, in one sense, it worked. There was a woman who I'm going to call Susan to protect her medical confidentiality, who went down from being more than 400 pounds to 138 pounds. It's astonishing. Everyone's celebrating. Dr. Felitti is being told that he saved her life. And then one day something happened that no one expected. Susan cracked. She goes to KFC or somewhere like that and starts obsessively eating. And pretty soon she's back at a terrible, dangerous weight. And Dr. Felitti called her in and he's like, Susan, what happened? She's really ashamed. She says, I don't know, I don't know. And then he said, well, tell me about the day that you cracked. Did anything happen that day that didn't happen any other day? It turns out something had happened that day that had never happened to Susan. She'd been in a bar and a man had hit on her, not in a horrible predatory way, in a nice way, but she felt really frightened. That's when Dr. Felitti thought to ask her, well, when did you start to put on your weight? Actually, for Susan, it was when she was 11. He said, well, did anything happen when you were 11 that didn't happen when you were 9 or 14, anything? She looked down and she said, yeah, that's when my grandfather started raping me. Dr. Felitti found out that 55% of them had put on their extreme weight in the aftermath of being sexually abused, which is such an extreme number and so much larger than the general population. At first, he's like, well, I don't understand. Susan put it to him really well. Overweight is overlooked, she said, and that's what I need to be. He began to realize this thing that seems so irrational and, of course, is bad for you, was actually performing a function, a positive function. It was protecting these people from sexual attention they had very good reason to want to ward off. But this is a pretty small study, right? So Dr. Felitti goes to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, and got a ton of funding to do a much bigger study. Everyone who came for healthcare to Kaiser Permanente for a whole year, for anything, headaches, broken legs, schizophrenia, the whole lot, was given a questionnaire with two parts. First part just said, have you had any of these problems as a kid? Things like extreme abuse, neglect. A second part asked, have you had any of these problems as an adult? Things like obesity. And then at the last minute, they added depression, suicide attempts, addiction. And when they added up the figures, people were just, there must be some mistake here. If you had six categories of childhood trauma, you were 3,100% more likely to have attempted suicide and 4,600% more likely to be an injecting drug user. I mean, you just don't get figures like that very often.
If you had all six of
them?
If
you had six of the 10, yeah.
Right.
So for each category you experienced, you were more likely to become, to have one of these problems. But it was when you got into the multiple categories that it just blew up. The way Dr. Robert Ander, who worked on the program, said to me, he said it made him realize, when we see someone who's behaving in these apparently dysfunctional ways, obesity, addiction, depression, we need to stop asking what's wrong with you and start asking what happened to you. I found this really difficult. When I interviewed Dr. Felitti the first time in San Diego, he's a lovely old man, he's an amazing, admirable person. And I remember shaking with anger when I left his office and I thinking, why am I so angry? And it really helped me to understand why I had stayed for so long with this simplistically and overly biological story about my own pain. Because when I was a child, I had experienced some very extreme forms of abuse over a long period of time. I didn't want to think about it. I didn't want to give this individual power over me now. I just didn't want to look at it all. But one of the reasons I'm really glad is because of what Dr. Felitti discovered next. And this is what I would stress to the person who's in that position. So if someone had indicated on their form that they'd experienced some form of childhood trauma, their doctor was told, don't call them back in, but next time they come in with a problem, say to them something like this. And the script was something like, I see that when you were a child, you were sexually abused or whatever it was. I'm really sorry that happened to you. That should never have happened. Would you like to talk about it? And 40% of people said, I don't want to talk about it, but 60% of people did. and they want to talk about it on average for 5 minutes. And then it was randomly assigned. Some of them could be referred to a therapist to talk about it more. What was extraordinary was just those 5 minutes of an authority figure saying, I'm really sorry, that should never have happened to you. That alone led to a really significant fall in depression and anxiety. And this is part of a much bigger body of evidence that I think is so important to stress to people who've gone through these things. It's one of the reasons why I make myself talk about it, although it's quite hard, is that evidence is from people like Professor Steve Coles at UCLA, who I just saw, it is not the trauma that destroys you. It is the shame about the trauma. And giving people safe places to release that shame is an antidepressant. It can reduce your depression and anxiety. And I think, again, it helped me to see why that simplistically biological story I was told was so problematic. Now, I don't want to be simplistic about this because I'm not sure if any doctor had asked me, I would have been able to talk about it. I probably wouldn't. But to be told, oh, it's just a problem in your brain can actually cut you off from seeking. If I had continued with that story forever, I would never have found that deeper solution, that releasing of shame from the trauma I had experienced. Do you see what I mean, Chris?
Is the key to get to the point where you understand, maybe for the first time, that this really, truly was not your fault in some way? Is it the sense of this was my fault is the toxic thing? In the story you told about Susan, you said that she was made fearful by being hit on. And so can a conversation get rid of that fear? You know, and I'm also sort of aware that these are such big issues, and they're so complex that it's neither for you nor me to sort of give any carte blanche advice, of course. And I think you'd be the first to say that.
Absolutely.
But what is the type of conversation that someone should seek out, and who is the best type of person for them to go and seek that out? Is they should just go and see a therapist and say, I need to talk about what happened?
I think there's lots of things in what you just said, and we don't want to be simplistic about it. And there's a big debate about why releasing shame reduces depression and anxiety. And often it doesn't have to be medical. So Professor Steve Coles did this really interesting, he's an extraordinary person, did this really interesting research during the AIDS crisis. Closeted gay men died on average 2 years earlier than openly gay men, even when they got healthcare at the same time. Why would that be? Because shame physically destroys you. It mentally destroys you. It suppresses your immune system. It does all sorts of terror. The strain and stress of that shame is so deep. Now, I suspect one of the things that's going on, I want to stress one of the things, not everything, is with childhood trauma, is something equivalent to no longer being a closeted gay man, right? Not holding this thing inside you. I think another thing that's going on, and this would be more like the insights that come from CBT, which you referred to before, is one thing that often happens with people who survive abuse is that you internalize the voice of your abuser. So usually when people are abused, they're told, you're making me do this, you deserve it. And I was told that. And even though there was never a point as an adult, obviously, that I would have thought most adults think like that, of course I knew they didn't. And of course, rationally, if I'd heard someone saying that about a child, I would have thought they were insane, right? Or a terrible person. But at some much deeper and more unconscious or subconscious level, or semi-conscious level, very often the voice of the abuser becomes internalized into your way of seeing the world, your thought patterns, your way of thinking about yourself. You don't think you deserve to be treated well. You don't think you... It affects your sense of self. Mm. And one of the things that's very powerful about talking to people about it, and I would recommend people go to their doctors and ask their advice if they think you're doing this, but actually just seeing that most people, when told that you've been abused, react the way those doctors were told to abuse, which is, I'm so sorry, that shouldn't have happened to you. That alone is why I think Me Too and Time's Up and all these movements can be really powerful. Now, people don't want to do it. I would urge people not to disclose those things in contexts where they think they might be shamed or, you know, or rhetorically attacked, because actually that could deepen the problem. It might actually give you the impression that there's more people with those voices, something like Twitter, which gives the impression that lots of people have these toxic voices when in fact very few people do. But yeah, does that answer your question? I don't want to give too overly detailed a question because it's such a subject of debate.
Right, and I think neither of us is a medical expert.
Yeah.
but the discussion about shame is really important, and I think it's powerful what you said. So you published this book, and it evoked a really strong reaction from a lot of people. Like I've read some of the reviews, a lot of people feel like you really touched them and revealed something incredibly important to them. There was some controversy among like some medics or other reviewers sort of felt that you might have oversimplified or been misleading in a couple of things. Could you just talk about the reaction to the book and the, like how you frame the controversy, if that's the right word, that, you know, that emerged from it? I mean, it's yeah. such an important topic. Everyone has strong opinions. What was the main
Yeah, I think it's worth stressing that the overwhelming response was really positive from a huge range of people, medical authorities, the former head of the mental health services for the whole of the British National Health Service, Dr. Geraldine Strathdee, called it amazing. The British Medical Association shortlisted it for an award. I can go through a whole range of big medical authorities. I think they were, in terms of the critical responses, that I think there were three kind of broad areas, one of which I think is not legitimate, and two of which I think are really worth thinking about, one of which I think is right in a way. So the kind of illegitimate one is a blogger for The Guardian, the day the book came out, admitted he hadn't read the book and accused the book of telling people to stop taking chemical antidepressants and stressed how dangerous that was. The Guardian subsequently published a clarification pointing out, as you know from having read the book, I don't say that. I think there's two much more thoughtful areas of criticism. One is there are some people like Dr. Andrea Cipriani at Oxford, who's a really admirable person, who argues that I underestimate the value of chemical antidepressants. He acknowledges that I'm not telling people to stop taking them. He agrees with me that we need a biopsychosocial model, that there are psychological and social causes that we need to deal with. But he thinks within that shared analysis, I am underestimating the value of chemical antidepressants. The third criticism, I think, is the legitimate one and a much more interesting one, which says, didn't we know all this? And I remember the night before the book came out, sitting with a good friend of mine and saying, I think most people are going to read this book. And they, you know, there are interesting stories and there's lots of detail people wouldn't know. But I was worried that what I had written was shockingly banal in a way, right? So let's think about, I explained that loneliness causes depression. If you'd asked my grandmother or your grandmother, hey, grandma, does being lonely make you more or less likely to become depressed? My grandmother would have asked me why I was asking such a stupid question, right? And yet the book came out and I kept being told that these arguments that I regard as banal in some ways, not the details, not the stories, there's lots of things people wouldn't know in the book. But a lot of these things that I regard as banal, I kept being told, but I mean, I remember one interview, I was talking about how loneliness causes depression, just like we were talking. And the interviewer said, well, this is a very controversial argument. And I'm just sitting there and thinking, how did we get to the point where saying loneliness causes depression is regarded as controversial? And I think it's interesting to think about that because the easy answer, which is not untrue, but I think is only a small part of the picture, is to go, Big Pharma did this to us, right? So think about Lisa, who took part in that gardening program that we talked about. There's a $10 billion industry telling Lisa she's got a problem in her brain and she needs to drug herself. And there's a $0 billion industry in telling her she might want to join a gardening program and make some friends, right? I mean, maybe not $0 billion because maybe Home Depot make a little bit of money out of it, but it ain't Big Pharma. There's some truth in that. I don't think it's the main thing that's going on. I think there's a more complex thing that's going on, which is related to how we've been taught to think about what we are as people. I think we do have to understand it in relation to this concept of needs, right? Everyone listening to your program knows that they have natural physical needs. Obviously, you need food, you need water, you need shelter, you need clean air. If I took those things away from you, you'd be in real trouble real fast. And going right back to the 50s, Abraham Maslow, all human beings have natural psychological needs. You need to feel you belong. You need to feel your life has meaning and purpose. You need to feel that people see you and value you. You need to feel you've got a future that makes sense.
What's interesting to me is that even though some of the ideas you've expressed and the views you've expressed are, you know, basically of the left, that's mainly where you're coming from. And yet this book has actually appealed to a lot of people on the right as well. I think because I'd be curious in your theory, but it seems to me it might be because it's giving people the responsibility and the possibility to take on their own depression and sorrow in sort of multiple meaningful ways. It's not sort of, you know, passing the buck to someone else. Why is it that you've had a response from people across the political spectrum to it?
It's a really good question. And the honest answer is I really don't know. And I'm really, I've been very struck by it. I think I've written the only book that's ever been praised by Noam Chomsky, Hillary Clinton, and Tucker Carlson. It's been a slightly surreal experience. And and I think, I'm guessing, I don't have a degree of confidence like I do with some of the other things we've talked about, but I think partly it's because this crisis of pain and despair runs right across the culture. And everyone can feel it, even if they're not in the throes of it themselves. And everyone can feel that what we're saying is there's something wrong with what we've been saying. And, you know, I think all the time about this woman that I met in the run-up to the 2016 election. I was in Cleveland canvassing to get out the vote. I'm sure you can guess who for. I was with the LA LGBT Center. I saw a wonderful guy called Dave Fleischer, who runs their deep canvassing project. And we were on a street in Cleveland where a third of the houses had been demolished, a third had been abandoned, and a third still had people living in them, often literally behind barbed wire. And we knock on this door and a woman answers, I would have guessed from looking at her was 60. I discovered from talking to her, she was actually 37 years old, same age as me at that time. I'm chatting to her and she was quite articulate. She was very angry. She was not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And she was talking about her life and she said, she was talking about what this area used to be like for her parents and grandparents. They left school when they were 16, they got good jobs. And she said, she made a verbal mistake. She meant to say when I was young. What she actually said is when I was alive. And she didn't notice she'd done it. And I thought, that's how she feels. And she's not wrong. She's been, through no fault of her own, deprived of the things that make life meaningful. And I think about, I've spent a lot of time, you know, you mentioned my previous book about addiction, Chasing the Scream. I spent a lot of time in some of the places that are epicenters of the opioid crisis. You know, the best research on that by Sir Angus Deighton and Professor Anne Case describes them as deaths of despair. That's what's going on there, right? If you deprive people of their basic psychological needs, they're going to be in deep pain. And I think that is an insight that cuts from left to right. And I try very hard to not activate the kind of tribal markers of left or right, although I am clearly a lefty, as you can tell, and proudly so. I think you can talk in a way that doesn't activate people's tribal identity and does speak to the pain that lies below those tribal identities. That I think, I don't want to be naive about this, but I do think opens up the possibility of building coalitions that begin to deal with some of the causes of that pain.
I mean, despair implies that you can't do anything. And the overwhelming message I take from the book is that there are multiple causes and each of those may have an action that could be taken to address that cause.
Absolutely. I'm deeply hopeful. We are really powerful when we stand together. We are not powerful when we are broken into isolated, atomized individuals, told that life is about buying crap and screaming at each other through screens. We've got to step away from that way of being and step towards the deep reconnection that people all around every listener are so hungry for.
Talk about your personal journey over the last few years, because you've been, you know, you've been researching depression in this very extraordinary way, like really wide ranging. You've traveled the world, you've talked to people in so many different areas, you've unearthed and in a way made heroes to an extent of this huge cast of medical practitioners and scientists, researchers and so forth. I mean, it's a really extraordinary project. And I presume that you've sought to put into practice some of these things that you're learning. So what you said earlier, right, was that the drugs were no longer being that effective for you. I know that you're not advising others to necessarily cut back on antidepressants. You yourself, however, have done that, like completely?
I stopped in 2011 over a long period of time. I think it's very important. My advice is not that people stop, but if you are going to stop, it's very important to do it over a long period of time because you can have quite severe withdrawal symptoms. It's actually very recently, in the last month or so, there's been a revised up medical advice on this. It used to be claimed about 20% of people get severe withdrawal effects. It actually seems to be significantly higher than that. And there's a big debate, medical debate going on about that at the moment. Either way, 20% would be a bad enough risk. If people want to stop, they need to stop very slowly. And I would argue that they should put in place some of the other changes. In terms of, I have not been depressed for a long time now. And again, I want to slightly caveat it by saying, I was in the extraordinarily privileged position that I could change my life in all sorts of ways. One of my closest relatives is a struggling single mother who works every hour she can to pay the rent and keep her kids in their home. And, you know, when she gets home, she just collapses and can barely watch television. So to say to her, your job now is to democratise your workplace, fight for a universal basic income, go out into the natural world, join a gardening programme, would be an insult to her, right? So I don't want to do that very American thing, no disrespect to Americans who I love dearly, where I kind of go, well, I did this, dear reader, and you can too. Most of the book is arguing for social changes that would set people free to make the kind of changes that I made and a lot of these scientists recommend. That said, I think there were a few things. So we've talked a bit about trauma, but in terms of myself, one of the biggest changes, and it's a bit embarrassing to talk about, to realise how much this played out in my own life. So everyone knows junk food has taken over our diets and made us physically sick, right? I say this with no sense of superiority. I literally came here from McDonald's. But there's equally strong evidence that a kind of junk values have taken over our minds and made us mentally sick. There were many things going on with my depression, but one of the things was when I felt depressed, one of the methods I would have to try to get out of this, the kind of folk methods that I'd invented for myself were learning from this message from the culture, was I would try to do something that looked impressive externally. I would make an achievement. I would try to look clever. I would show off on Twitter. I would try to earn more money. I would buy something expensive. I would do someone down, a different way of trying to big up your own status. And now I realize that was like the guy trying to reach in with his arms to pull out his legs in the quicksand. I thought it was getting me out, but it was actually sinking me deeper in. I was looking for happiness in the wrong places. I'd been taught to value the wrong things. And when I felt the pain of that, I would double down on it rather than try to get out of it. So for thousands of years, philosophers have said, if you think life is about money and status and showing off, you're going to feel like crap, right? That's not an exact quote from Confucius. That is the gist of what he said, right? But no one had actually scientifically investigated this until an incredible man who you should totally have do a TED Talk. He's extraordinary. A guy called Professor Tim Kasser, who's at Knox College in Illinois. Professor Kasser showed a few really important things. So he explained to me, it's actually known before him, this part, but then he made a series of breakthroughs about it. Everyone listening to your show, all humans you'll ever meet who aren't in comas, have two kinds of motivation. Imagine you play the piano in the morning because you love it and it gives you joy. That's what's called an intrinsic reason to play the piano. You're not doing it to get anything out of it. You're doing it because that experience is a moment you flow into and is meaningful to you. Now imagine you play the piano, not because you love it, but because your parents are massively pressuring you to be a piano maestro. That's their dream. Or in a dive bar to pay the rent where you can't stand it. Or to post the clips on Instagram to impress a man. I don't know, there might be a piano fetishist out there, right? That's what's called an extrinsic reason to play the piano. You're not doing it because that experience is meaningful. You're doing it to get something out of it. Now, we're all a mixture of both kinds of motivation. You have to be as a human being. But Professor Kasser has shown a few things. The more you are driven by these extrinsic values, which I increasingly began to think are kind of analogous to junk food, the more likely you are to become depressed and anxious. By quite a significant amount, there's a big debate about why that I go through in the book. I think partly it's because that way of living just doesn't meet your deeper needs as a human being. Professor Kasser also showed, as a society, as a culture, we have become much more driven by these extrinsic values. You know, there's a little symbol of it that I keep thinking of. I saw it quite recently. I was at Elton John's last night at Caesar's Palace. It's an incredible thing to be at. He's an astonishing live performer. And I would say a third of the audience did not look at Elton John once. They stare at him through a little camera screen, right? And you want to turn to them and go, I mean, I really nearly did. You want to turn to them and go, no one wants to see your cell phone video of Elton John. If people want to see a video of Elton John, they can click on YouTube. There are amazing videos of Elton John. And they know that. Why are they doing that? They're never going to watch that video either. They're doing it because they've been hijacked by these junk values. What they want to do is say to everyone else, I was at the Elton John concert and you weren't. Because in some ways, when Professor Kasser was explaining this to me, I was like, this is both really revelatory and kind of banal, right? Like, everyone knows they're not going to lie on their deathbed and think about all the likes they got on Instagram and all the shoes they bought. You're going to think about moments of meaning and connection. But as Professor Kasser put it to me, we all live in a machine that is designed to get us to neglect what is meaningful about life.
So has that made the biggest difference to you personally, to focus on things that are meaningful in and of themselves in the moment?
Yeah, there's this metaphor I kept thinking of years ago. And if anyone listening knows this, please send it to me because I can't find it. I saw a silent film clip. In my memory, it's Buster Keaton, but that might be wrong. So whoever it is sinking in quicksand. His legs are sinking. So he reaches in with his arms to pull out his legs, which of course means he sinks faster. And then he reaches in with his head to pull out his arms and he's gone. So Professor Castle showed this really amazing thing, just very quickly, there's a simple thing. He worked with this wonderful guy called Nathan Dungan in Minneapolis, which is this very simple thing. You just get people to meet once every couple of weeks and talk about moments that have actually been meaningful in their lives. And how could you spend more of your time seeking those things and less of your time seeking the junk values? And yeah, it was like a kind of Alcoholics Anonymous for junk values, for the kind of consumerist values that we're pumped full of all the time. And it led to a significant shift in people's values. We don't have spaces to have those conversations in our culture very often. So that was a big reorientation that I made. You know, just like you say, working on these books where for 3 years I can go away and just look at something from every angle, sit with it, learn about it, reflect on it, go back to these people again and again and say, well, you know, have I got this right? What about this? What about that? That's such a deeply meaningful thing to me that it led to I think it's one of the factors among several that led to a real remission in depression. Now, I understand a lot of people, like a lot of my family, will think, well, I can't do that. And that's why most of the solutions are about arguing for how we change the society so more people are free to make those kind of changes that they want to make. When I was a kid, Margaret Thatcher famously said something like, there's no such thing as society, there's only individuals and their families. And Margaret Thatcher won much more deeply than just in political terms. I think about myself. I never liked Margaret Thatcher. You can probably guess my politics. And yet, all those years I was depressed, I had studied social sciences, right? And I was not a Thatcherite. It didn't even occur to me that there were these deeper social drivers of my depression and anxiety. Or if those thoughts came to me, I wouldn't say it never occurred to me, but I would fend them off very quickly. They seemed to me to be, I did not assimilate them deeply, right? And I think if you live in a society that has genuinely been told there is no such thing as society, right? That's prevailed very deeply in the United States, in Britain, the countries where I live. Social explanations will seem weird. It's like speaking a language that no one talks. They'll just seem out of left field. They'll seem counterintuitive. So I think partly what's gone on is there's become a disjunction between individualistic narratives that have come to dominate our culture, which tell us if there's a problem in you. And it's your job as an isolated individual to solve it. Think about even these self-help cliches that people post on Facebook. The only person who can help you is you. And we've got a disjunction between that way of thinking and our actual needs as human beings, as people who evolved to live in tribes, to have meaningful work, to depend on each other, to only feel good when we're in reciprocal relationships of dependency with other human beings. I think there's this weird, jarring thing that's happened. And I think what happened, I think one of the reasons why you can have a situation where my book is simultaneously banal and obvious and controversial and revolutionary is because it goes right to the heart, and these are not my insights, they're the insights of these scientists. It goes right to the heart of that jam, that kind of point of conflict in the culture between the individualistic stories that dominate the culture and the reality of our actual psychological needs. Does that make sense? Maybe I'm being self-exculpating.
This question of who are we is so fundamental for so many things, including, you know, the future of politics. I mean, you could argue throughout the Enlightenment that the whole nature of Western thought was to try and better understand the individual. You know, there's Descartes imagining himself solo. All he feels is this consciousness. Mm-hmm. Who am I? What can I deduce from that? And, you know, John Locke, John Stuart Mill, like all these thinkers are fundamentally saying, what is it to be alive, me as an individual? And then, yes, the way in which we have created economic theory has been, you know, here is the rational agent looking after their interests. The idea of liberty is often framed as start with an individual and allow, you know, an individual with desires and needs, give them as much room as you possibly can for them to express those needs, so long as they don't hurt someone else. But it's the whole model is of these different bubbles bumping against each other. And it's a very sharp distinction from Eastern frames of thought, which start with the community. You know, you are fundamentally a social person, you're a member of a community, and your own interests and your own needs don't think about them so much. Stop it. Stop that. You know, what about your family? What about your village? What about your tribe and, you know, your brothers and sisters?
I love the way you put that, Chris. And there's a really interesting test to this. Again, it was one of the things I found really challenging in the research for the book because I could see what I'd been getting wrong. I went to Berkeley to interview a woman called Dr. Brett Ford. She's in Toronto now, brilliant academic. She did this research with lots of her colleagues, both in Berkeley and internationally, that I found fascinating. So it looked at, if you try deliberately to make yourself consciously happier, does it work? And they looked at this in four countries. So let's say you decided I was going to say, I'm going to spend an hour a day trying to make myself happier. Would you actually become happier? And they studied this in four countries, the United States, Japan, Russia, and Taiwan. And what they found at first seems really weird. Goes to exactly the insight you just said. So, well, in the United States, if you try to make yourself happier, you do not become happier. In the other countries, if you try consciously to become happier, you do. And they were like, what's going on? How can that be? When they looked at it more, what they discovered is, in the United States, in general, there are exceptions. If you try to make yourself happier, generally, you do something for yourself. You try to earn more money, you big yourself up, you show off on Instagram, a lot of the stuff I used to do. I still do to some degree. In the other countries, if you try to make yourself happier, generally you do something for someone else, your friends, your family, your community. So we have an implicitly individualistic idea of what it means to be a happy human being. They have an instinctively collectivist idea of what it means to be a happy human being. And it turns out our vision of happiness just ain't, we're not that species. Individualism, lovely theory, don't work for us. That's not a species of individualists wouldn't have banded together in tribes on the savannas of Africa, and we wouldn't be sitting here in New York City having this conversation because they would have died out. A species of Ayn Randian individualists would not be able to keep itself going, right? I forget who pointed this out, but Ayn Rand's novels, no one has any children. Right? But I mean, there are some adults who have adult children, but no one has any children under the age of 18. Because if you were an Ayn Randian who believed that, you know, selfishness is a virtue, your children would just die, right? We only survive because of altruism.
Let's try and pull some of the threads together here.
Sure.
So it feels like, tell me if this is right, like to tell a full story about depression or indeed about happiness and the possibilities of happiness for that matter, involves refusing to take a simplistic view of who we are. We can't just tell the bio story. You know, we've got complex brains. It is completely possible that some of us are more prone to responding sensitively.
Yeah, it's not just possible. It's known.
It's known.
Yeah.
So some of us have that potential, and therefore there may be, you know, chemistry may play a role in all this. But these brains are not living in vats by themselves. They are living in very complex worlds where there's all kinds of other things going on. And it matters what we believe about ourselves. It matters what we believe about our work. It matters what relationships we have. It matters what our connection with nature is. It matters what other people think of us and whether we have meaningful relationships with. All these things are profoundly important. And really the only way to think about this is not to, there is no silver bullet, there is no one thing, but that we should think of ourselves as just these really rich, complex creatures that need many things for a full, flourishing life. Is that a fair sort of summary of part of your mindset?
I think
mindset?
You put that beautifully. I should have got you to write the conclusion for me. I think that's really beautiful. I think you're totally right. We don't want to replace a simplistically biological story about depression with a simplistically psychological story or a simplistically social story. We want to be truthful to the complexity of this problem. I think you put it brilliantly when you talk about, you know, the brain doesn't exist in isolation. Professor Cacioppo, the loneliness expert who was based in Chicago, he was the pioneer of something that he called social neuroscience. Your brain changes according to how you use it. We know this about other parts of our body. If I start lifting weights, which as you can see, I have not done in many years, my arms will get bigger, right? Doesn't mean I've got an arm disease. It means I'm using my arms differently. Your brain is like that. Your brain changes according to how you use it. The way we live, the environment, turns many expressions of your genes on and off. There's a good study of this. Massive population study of New Zealand by a guy called Professor Avshalom Caspi that found a particular gene. It's called the H5TT gene that correlates with depression. But what's interesting is if you carry the H5TT gene, you are more likely to become depressed if you become acutely lonely or you experience childhood trauma. If you carry the H5TT gene and neither of those things happen to you, you're no more likely to become depressed than anyone else. So again, it shows it's too simplistic to say this is in your genes. This is in your brain.
It's not destiny, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Your genes and your brain interact with our environment. If you tell people a simplistically biological story, what you're saying to them is your pain doesn't mean anything. It's like a piece of broken code in a computer. But one of the things that I think has really been one of the dominant themes in our conversation, Chris, is to explain to people your pain makes sense. You feel these ways for reasons. Those reasons are understandable and together, probably not as an isolated individual can this be solved, but together as a society, we can solve these underlying problems.
So the original book that really made so many people aware of the power of antidepressants, it was called Listening to Prozac, right? And in a way, the whole theme of what you're saying is, fine, listen to Prozac, but also listen to everything else.
Oh, I wish you'd give me that phrase when I was writing the book. That's great. I actually interviewed Peter Kramer, who wrote that book. I think you're right. If he's saying listen to Prozac, I'm saying listen to people. Some of those people will tell you that Prozac helped them, and that's important, and we should honour that experience. But they will tell you a much more complicated picture because the science shows a much more complicated picture.
Johan, one last chance to inject one idea into the minds of people listening.
Inject makes it sound quite violent, right?
It's peaceful. It's done in a blissful way
through
airwaves. your lovely voice drifting out into their headphones and going into their brain and changing their mind forever. What's that dangerous or not or beautiful idea that you want to release?
I would say your pain makes sense. If you're in pain, you feel that way for reasons. You're not crazy to feel that way. It's not because you're weak. It's not because you're biologically broken. We are in pain as a society and a culture for perfectly understandable reasons that make sense, that are not insane, and we can deal with those reasons together.
Johan, this has been an absolute treat to go into all these areas, you know, intimate areas, challenging areas. It's been really, really interesting. Thank you for all you've studied and all you've shared.
Oh, it's totally a joy. Thank you so much, Chris.
Johan Hari is the author of Lost Connections. For more information, go to thelostconnections.com. And to listen to Johan's TED Talk, visit TED.com. This week's show was produced by Megan Tan. Our production manager is Roxanne Hilash. Our mix engineer, David Herman. Our theme music is by Alison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to my colleague, Michelle Quint. Now, if you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening, or find some other way of sharing with anyone you know who is curious. Thank you for listening.